The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media.
Broadcasting from beautiful Burbank, California, the Knapsack Files has moved and we are in our new studios, kind of getting settled in. And that is why I haven't had interviews on the show for a while. If you've been following along, you know why. I have been in process of moving from Studio City, sexy, steamy Studio City, to beautiful Burbank. The move is complete. I am in the house, still working on some of the issues, but I finally can open up the studio thanks to the fine folks at Rode Microphones, who are making this show sound so crisp tonight. I got some brand new gear, love it, and the studio is back open and full, and I cannot think of a better guest to bring in for this new stuff than someone who has been on the Knapsack Files a couple times before, and even we had a show here on for a while that we tried that should have worked in a different universe, but schedules made it very difficult. It is the wonderful, talented, insightful Alicia Malone.
Hello. I love hearing your podcast voice.
Everyone loves
sounds
the
good.
Podcast voice.
Sounds so good.
And it sounds crisp and clear. And Alicia, it's so good to have you back. And it's LA, so we get to catch up on podcasts.
Yes, that's very LA thing to do.
Very LA thing. But for a good reason. You have a book that is actually out this week that you have been slaving over for a long time. You've been working so damn hard.
Yes.
Called Backward In and Heels.
Yes.
Tell me about the book up top, and then we'll get into the process and how this came about and the big, big life decisions you made to really concentrate on something like this.
Yeah, I can't believe that it's out this week. I mean, it feels really surreal. I kind of feel like I want to hide. At the same time, I want to scream from the rooftops. It's kind of a weird feeling, but it's called Backwards and in Heels, and it's about the past, present, future for women working in film. And I wanted to look at the history of women in Hollywood, but I didn't want to just tell it in a straight chronological way. So it is set chronologically, but what it does is for every era, I first do a overview chapter of what was just happening in the film world during that time, what was happening in America with women, and then I pick four or five stories to illustrate that era, that decade. Wow. And then as you get into the present day, I've done a bunch of interviews with great people like Gina Davis and J.J. Abrams and Ava DuVernay and Octavia Spencer, America Ferrera, as well as cinematographers, editors, producers, executives, trying to look at all sides for women in Hollywood.
Now, without a doubt, women in film and those kind of issues and the history of it was something very close to you that's never been a secret, never been something. But you decided to make this is not something you wanted to keep close to your heart anymore. You wanted to broadcast aloud to the world and put your heart into this book.
Yeah. Yes, I did. And it's still strange to me that I've sort of started to speak out about these issues and become kind of a speaker on this because, I mean, I was so shy growing up and I didn't really imagine this is what I would do. I kind of never even thought of myself as a feminist because I just thought, oh, it's what everyone believes, right? Equality.
Right.
It wasn't until I started working in the field and I started to get pushback from people when I speak about women in film that I thought, hang on a second, this is something that needs to be talked about. Right. And then all those comments on YouTube just fueled my fire. And now I was like, you know what? I'm going to stand up and talk about this.
Are you saying YouTube is rife with bad people and bad thoughts?
Yes, very vocal minority. Yeah. And it really shocked me the first time it happened. It was on AMC Movie Talk.
Right.
And I think I said something as simple as like, yay, female Ghostbusters, like way back when it was just sort of an inkling of an idea. And the amount of comments I got just being outraged that I would possibly support something that was an all-female production. And, you know, that project in particular was rife with a lot of feelings, but I was so surprised by it that I got depressed for a little while and I thought maybe I shouldn't talk about it. Then I thought, nah, screw that. I'm going to talk about it even more. So then it just became kind of my thing.
Yeah, no, well, and a good thing for sure, but it's also, again, it's one thing, look, it's one thing to tweet it.
Yeah,
you're putting your life into this right now. You're putting your life's work, everything about it. I know this isn't This is a comprehensive history. This is probably challenges ideas, and it's also positive in the sense of you're trying to build up a next generation behind you too.
Exactly.
Breaking down walls means other people are coming in. So this is important.
Yes.
But important doesn't mean it's not. It doesn't make it easy.
Yeah.
And doesn't mean it's not a tough decision.
Yeah.
So. You talk about being shy, and you've done TED Talks since we last had.
Yeah, that's
right. How
did
that come about?
Well, that came about because I started speaking out on all these shows. And so then it became a thing of like, oh, that's Alicia, and that's what she does. And so I got approached by a small TEDx company, like a small TEDx event that was happening just off Seattle in San Juan Islands. And they said to me, you know, you speak out for women and on Twitter as well, not just on YouTube, but all over. Would you ever consider doing a TEDx talk about this issue? You know, I think you would have something interesting to say. Mm-hmm. And I had always had it like on a bucket list kind of thing of like one day do a TED talk.
Really?
But
that's very specific.
Yeah. I was like one day, but I had no idea what it would be about.
Right.
Yeah. This is like, I found the list the other day and I wrote 100 things that it was like 100 dream list or something that I'd bought from someplace in Australia, and you had to fill out your 100 things. And one of them was do a TEDx talk. One of them was also write a book. And that was way higher on my list. That was something I've always wanted to do. So yeah, I got approached to do that TEDx talk, and it was again one of these things that happens a lot with me where I go, oh, I'm not good enough. I got nothing to say. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could do this. And then no, I'm going to do it. And then fake it till I make it, and then figure it out as I go along. So I got included in that TEDx event, and that was a whole process too, learning how to write a TED talk. There's very specific things that you need to hit when you're doing a TED talk, mainly the idea worth sharing. So like, what is that idea? What do you bring to that idea that no one else does? And what is the takeaway? And that was the hard thing for me. What can the audience do when they're watching this TEDx talk? What can they walk away with? Actionable item that they can do themselves to help fix this problem.
That's fascinating. I want to dig into that a little bit because it seems like, sure, make a speech.
Yeah.
But the fact that it would make sense, TED Talk is a brand, so they're going to want to have a way to do it. And I'm sure you watched and researched. But how long did it take you to get your first idea out? Because, again, it's easy to be like, hey, here's what I believe, but how do I actually communicate that?
It took months. It took months. And you work with a TEDx coach. So when you get accepted into this, they assign speaker coaches, and they're from the local area, and they might not necessarily be public speaking experts, but they've been trained in what you have to do to create a good TEDx talk. And they're also a sounding board for you to go back and forth with your idea.
Okay.
So months of like drafts and figuring things out, and there was a while there which I thought, I can't, like, this is not working and I'm not going to be able to do this, and this happens every time with me.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not getting there. I'm almost there but not quite, and what am I trying to say?
Right.
There's a lot of talking with friends and a lot of sending like audio messages to people of, what do you think about this and what do you think about that? And then one day sort of getting the ting, oh, yes, I know how to bring it all together.
Right.
And figuring it all out last minute and then learning it and then going on stage.
Do you have to memorize it, or they get
prompt? You have to memorize it.
Get out of here.
Yeah, you have to memorize it. There's no teleprompter, and you get an allotted amount of time based on your draft.
Sure.
So you can do 10 minutes to 30 minutes, and I wanted to hit around 13, 14 minutes. And then you go there and you do your rehearsal, you know, in the big red dot that they all have and the letters behind you.
Did you get like
and then the next day you do it.
Like a microphone, little headset, like a Miley Cyrus headset.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
you get that little thing. And then the funny thing was, I realized when I did it, and I've done two now and I do the same thing every time, is I'm so used to presenting to a camera that I just stay in the one spot. And I remember to look at the audience, but I'm just stuck in this one position.
You don't have that TED Talk stroll down yet.
Yeah, I don't have to stroll. Because you got to stroll and stay in the red dot. So it's a very specific thing. And you also have a clicker to do slides at the same time.
Did you get a slide? You get some slides?
Yeah, you have to make your own slides. So I made my own slides. And the first time I did it, it didn't occur to me that slides are probably the good way of like making you remember what you're going to say next.
Yeah, okay.
That would be a smart way to use slides, you know, where you click on the slide and then that prompts you to your next point. But instead I made slides that I had to remember to click them forward, and they, you know, but it worked out in the end. I've got a really good short-term memory, so
it worked out. And but to get to that point, look, this might be, you know, you've been open with some of the stuff on past podcasts, even on the Knapsack Files, and just some stuff that you know, it would be easy to look at you, this vivacious Australian hitting the California shores, with a great ability to speak and a lot of knowledge and wit and intelligence about it. It'd be very easy to look at you and say you've got this. But the fact that in your head you're like, I don't know if I got this.
Mm-mm.
You had to get to this point. And speaking in front of people is probably not a big problem for you.
Yeah.
You're like me, you probably have a bigger problem going to a party.
Absolutely.
I think big people. Yeah. But again, something that's so close to your heart, that's important to you.
Yeah.
But the act of communicating it and then the doubt, because again, if you're going to speak out on something that shouldn't be controversial, the idea of equality for women or equality of women in film shouldn't be controversial, but it unfortunately is going to, it might be. So you've got these kind of doubts. How did you combat those doubts? Was it just jumping out of the plane?
Yeah, it's just jumping out and doing it. I was so nervous. I constantly suffer from the imposter syndrome, the why me? I'm not good enough. What am I doing?
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah, where you're waiting for someone to come behind you with the big hook and be like, hook you off stage or tap you on the back and say, how did you sneak in here? I'm on to you. I've been
Alicia Malone,
you.
How do you think you know about film? You're out of here.
Please. Get out of here. What do you know?
Right.
So I constantly battle with that, still do. And with the fact that I grew up really shy, to the point where if someone would look at me, I'd go bright red.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you say, like, yeah, I'm definitely more comfortable talking to thousands than talking to one person.
Yeah.
I get anxiety when I go to parties, and cancelled plans are my favorite things ever.
Yes.
'Cause it means I can stay at home and watch movies by myself, and I love it. But yeah, I have to just really, I think when I started on television, I had to really fake it till I make it, like put on a confident air.
Sure.
Until it became natural. Now, actually, what I'm trying to work on is being more myself, being more authentic. Because now I can switch so easily into presenter mode.
That mode.
Where I smile and, hi, everyone, it's Alicia Malone. But I want to be able to show more of myself, particularly when I'm doing interviews. You know, you want to connect with someone, you want to show your vulnerability and have that resonate with someone. So I'm figuring that out. But as far as the TEDx talk, there was that whole big self-doubt, emotional roller coaster, but kind of the thing of like, well, I'm locked in now and I got to do it and I'm never going to let someone else down and I'm in the program, so I got to do it and I got the deadline, so I just got to do it.
Got to do it.
And then put on the smile and walk out and just own it for a second and then walk out and be like, how did I do? I have no idea. Did I do okay? Who was watching? Oh, Ben, never look at those YouTube comments.
Yeah, never look at those. Never look at those. Was the second one easier?
Second one was harder because I was like, what do I have to say that's different from the first?
So you can't just do the same speech?
No. It's different.
It's not like stand-up comedy where you get your set.
And you know, yeah, exactly. It's, I wish it was. And you know, it's like, you know me.
Yeah.
I take on too much.
Sure.
And so I submitted myself for a second TEDx talk. Mm-hmm. It was someone that I met during the first TEDx talk, and they ran a bigger event in Oregon. And so they said, you should apply for a TEDx talk. And I thought, yeah, I'll do it. And I applied and I got in. And then I realized that I would be writing this book and doing a TED talk simultaneously, to the point where the TEDx talk was happening in the deadline of my book.
Yeah.
So I got to a point where I freaked out. My poor speaker coach really had to talk me off the ledge for that one.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't do this. I took on too much. I don't know what I'm doing. I have nothing interesting to say. I've got nothing different to say. What am I going to do? Like, I have nothing here. And they had to really talk me off the ledge and be like, no, you're fine. You'll get it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not figured out till 2 days before I went on stage.
Ah, you got it.
Oh, yeah. I was like, I don't have this. And all the feedback I got from my TEDx talks, I mean, I was like, I don't mind brutal feedback. I'm used to it. But it was like, nah, this is not interesting. This is nothing
really
to say. There's no takeaway for the audience. We've heard this lots of times. She can do this if she wants, but it's not going to resonate. Oh, So I had to really buckle down and figure it out. And then last minute, it all came together. And then the onstage thing, I mean, I remembered it. It seemed to go well, but same thing of like, what am I doing?
What are you doing? But what are you are doing, you're doing good things. Have you ever, what are some of the things that have happened? Have you had any contact with the audience that, that makes you feel like you all worth it? And I'm not talking about the glory and the spotlight on you. That's nothing. That's nothing. That's not why you're doing it for. What have you felt? Has it impacted you in that way?
Yeah, the first TEDx talk I did, it was a small audience. So when you looked out from the stage, it didn't look that impressive. But I knew that this video lasts on YouTube forever.
Right.
But in the audience was a young girl and her father. And she came up to me afterwards and was really excited to meet me. Had never heard of me before this TED talk. Mm-hmm. And her father said that she started crying during it and looked over to him and said, "She's speaking for me, Dad."
How old was she?
"She's fighting for me." Oh, she was like 7 or 8.
Oh, so that's great.
Yeah, and I thought that's what I'm doing it for. Like it makes it all worthwhile.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Same with the tweets that I get from people who say, you know, "Thank you for speaking out," or "You're an inspiration because you speak out." I mean, that makes it all worthwhile. And also when I have the moments of like, who am I to talk about this or should I be talking about this? Mm-hmm. I just think of the larger issues and what I'm trying to do, which is trying to use my little platform that I've been very lucky to get for something that's worthwhile. And I feel like I can be that voice for young girls out there who love movies and they'd love to see themselves represented more often.
Absolutely. And it's you know, who are you? It's like, who are you not to?
Exactly.
Are you not to? This is part of what you're here for.
Yeah. And that also makes me, that's something that keeps me going, is to think, well, I mean, I wouldn't be happy with just having a platform and not using it for something.
Yeah.
Something good.
Yeah. Some kind
of something that I really believe in.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is something that runs deep and always has. And it's not like you found some marketing niche. You know what I mean?
No.
Like this is something that's been of you, as is this book, which probably came out of your soul. But that's easier said than done. I've tried to write a book, tried to write a novel. Uh-huh. There's a manuscript somewhere that's horrible. I have other failed writing ideas. I know how hard this is, and I know other authors. And you're a writer. You've done a lot of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But authoring a book is an entire different world. So you decide to go in. Is this on your bucket list as well?
Yes. On my all-time bucket list.
All-time
from
bucket
when
list.
I was really young.
Just a book or
a book?
Any kind of book.
Any kind of book.
Okay.
Any kind of book I thought definitely would be a film book.
Yeah,
I used to read so many film books when I was young. And I always said quietly to myself, I never shared it because I was shy about writing or saying I wanted to be an author.
Right.
But I always said to myself, it would be so exciting to see my name on the front cover of a book. And that was always a goal for me.
Yeah.
Again, didn't think I was good enough, but I've always, it's a theme. I've always been a writer. I've always written things. I've been published in film magazines and I've done lots of writing courses. But I didn't know whether I could actually do it.
Okay, you joke it's a theme. I mean, not joke. I get it. It's I get where you're coming from. It's a theme. You're not good enough. But what you're also very good at is just close your eyes and just jump. This fake it till you make it idea is I think how a lot of life is learned. And for you, this I don't know. Help me explain it. But it's like you went through a bit of a career shift and. Not that you, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but it's like you had a lot of fun doing what you're doing, being a pundit in a lot of places, but you wanted to, you yourself say, Alicia Malone doesn't say no to a lot of things. Alicia Malone's going to work. You're going to try to, I know you as, you know, I would call you a screen junkie. Say, "Can you come in tomorrow to this?" Yeah, I'll do it. I'll find out. I'll have to run over and figure out, I'll move this. I'll get a helicopter to fly over here.
Somehow, I'll do it. Yeah.
And work is work. And as much as it is fun to talk about some of these things, work can wear down, and you felt you were spread too thin and you wanted to take this was now is the time to focus on you and your goals.
Exactly. Yeah, I had that thought of I am almost killing myself with work. I was getting sick a lot. I wasn't sleeping very well. I was getting so anxious. I felt like I was always letting people down because I was always double booked for things and underprepared. And it is such a fun job. So it's hard to say no to things.
Underprepared. on. I'm going to stop you for
a second to say for yourself. But I know I always have notes, and I'm always ready to go.
Yes, as a producer of a show that would be like, "Hi, welcome. Can you host all of this today?"
Yeah.
You've never let anyone down, especially me as a producer, or as a co-host, or a co-worker, or a friend. So I get that's part of your charm. But I'm sure something you worked through too. But yeah. So. Again, this was me time. It was Alicia Malone time, which for you and for a lot of people, that's hard.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to say no. I'm a people pleaser. Mm-hmm. I always want to do the best for people. And being a freelancer, you know, moving to LA and not having much money and having no job, I hustled so hard to get where I was that I felt like I couldn't say no, or I shouldn't say no. But I had to really take a step back and look at myself and my life, where I had no time for friends and I was just work the whole time. And also I started to feel like I was taking someone else's spot. So I started to feel like, you know, all the shows that I worked on, of course, the big views, the big money makers, whatever it is, comic books, the superhero films, and Star Wars, and Game of Thrones, and stuff that I'm just naturally not into, and I never have been. And so I feel like I was taking someone else's spot by saying yes to all these jobs, and I should vacate and give it to the next person that's coming up, and it would be a great training ground for them, and someone who does know a lot about that, and someone who is passionate about that. I mean, the amount of research I had to do half the time to make my way through some of those, you know.
Like, what's a Star Wars?
Yeah, because, of course, I would be honest and say this is not my forte, and then you would get crucified in the comments for that.
And also
you get crucified if you didn't know everything. So it was a hard position to be in.
Yeah.
And it was stressful. So I just had to take a step back and be like, this might freak me out by saying this, but I'm just going to say no to everything I don't want to do and really focus on the areas specifically in film that I love and, again, that I feel like I can be the most use for, and that is supporting independent filmmakers by talking about indie films, talking about film festivals, classic movies, and women in film.
Right.
So I thought those are the three areas I'm going to focus on. I'm going to say no to everything else and really clear the slate.
Yeah.
Amazing that when I did that, everything shifted and everything came true.
Well,
made room for
that's
a good opportunity.
The transition I wanted to get to, because it seems like some weird hippy-dippy kind of the secret type thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, put a thing on your wall and focus on it. But
it happens.
There's something about it. There's some particles in the air because, you know, I know you and I had some conversations about it, and next thing you know, it's happening. And it's not dumb luck. I mean, opportunity comes and you got to jump at it. But, yeah, it was really impressive, and I had a lot of respect for you. I knew where you were coming from, but it was just like, wow, this is happening, and she's doing it.
Yeah, I was in that spot where I was like, well, I'm involved in these really popular brands. I'm doing everything I want to do. It's not quite making me happy and fulfilled, so I have to just say no and trust that something's going to come that's better for me. And I think, you know, I do believe in writing goals, and I do believe in, like, visualizing things, but, of course, you have to work at it. You can't just be like, I want $1 million and then not do anything about it. But I really started to focus on it, and so that meant, you know, using my own YouTube channel to talk about these movies, which I always believe that work begets work. So if you focus on the things that you love doing, even if you're only your mom's watching, it actually helps to take you on that path and on that goal. So I was making, you know, YouTube videos about indie films, and that's when Fandango said, well, why don't you create, you know, what would you like to do? Would you like to create a show about independent films? Because we see you talking about indie films on your YouTube. I was like, yes. So I got that. I got the Indie Movie Guide, which I created, and I host, edit, produce, and shoot it all in my own apartment every week. And I love it because I get to talk about these films that no one else talks about.
Working from home.
and working from home. So good. And then I was, you know, I had on my list of goals from when I first moved over to the US that I really wanted to work for TCM, for Turner Classic Movies.
Right.
And when we're at AfterBuzz Studios, podcast studios, and I was doing profiles with Scott Mantz, you know, Kevin there would have meetings with hosts one-on-one where they would talk about what you wanted to do in the future. And even though for a while there I thought, well, I mean, I've already got all this work and I'm kind of established as a host, I thought I'll still go along to this little seminar one-on-one and talk to him. And
can't hurt.
And he was like, so what do you want to do in the future? And I said, I want to work with Turner Classic Movies. And he said, oh, I know the head of talent at Turner Classic Movies if you want me to put you in touch. And I was like, that'd be great. And then as soon as I walked out, I was like, I'm not ready for that yet. And it, you know, a little bit of like, I'm not good enough, but also a genuine thought of like, not yet. But then a couple of years, you know, once I cleared the decks, I thought, you know what? I'm going to email him.
Yeah.
And just do a new show reel that shows all my classic movie stuff and send it on. Who knows?
Right.
At that time, Turner Classic Movies was starting to partner with Criterion Collection to create Filmstruck, their streaming app.
Right.
Little did I know they were looking for hosts.
Right.
So they actually, Darcy, who was head of talent at the time, she reached out to me. She said, well, this is great actually because I'm going to be in LA for the film festival. Do you want to meet up and have coffee? So we did, and we talked about naturally the films that I love, which is a lot of foreign films, a lot of art house and indie films. And then the next thing I knew, she said, do you want to come to Atlanta to do a to do an audition with Turner Classic Movies? And I got to Atlanta and I still didn't really know what it was for.
Right.
But I saw on the makeup, the door of the makeup room, the note that said TCM, the logo, and then my name, Alicia Malone, printed on the door.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, nothing else happens. I've made it. So I said to them, I was like, sorry, I just have to take a picture of this.
Picture.
Like a big dork.
Yeah.
I was really nervous during the audition and then I didn't hear anything for a couple of months. They asked me to help out with some Q&As at the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival.
Mm.
Did that. Then they took me out to lunch and said, we'd like to offer you a job as a host on Filmstruck. And I was like, wow, this is perfect. It's about foreign indie cult art house classic films that I love. It's with Turner Classic Movies. It's with Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
It's a dream come true. And all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I'm focused on indies, foreign films, classics. I love this.
You zeroed in. You focused it. You earned it.
I made it.
You earned it, little Alicia Malone. You earned it. And, I remember this process of hearing you were going for it. It was just like this thing of it just seemed, you know, from the outside looking in, it's a perfect match. But to go through all that stuff and, again, to put yourself out there.
Yes.
Fake it till you make it. Nervous at these auditions. I get it. But
exactly. And just emailing, you know, in the first place.
And putting yourself out there.
Hey,
again.
I'd love to work with you guys.
Yeah. There's a theme here. That's the theme. The theme is not I'm not good enough.
The theme is like thinking I'm not good enough, but doing it anyway.
Facing
the fear and doing it anyway.
Like, say, writing this book.
Yes.
So how do you even start? Do you mind if I hold this book? I got my copy on the way, and you guys can order yours on Amazon.
Feel free.
But how did this specific book come out? I know you have a list of, I'm going to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
You got it on a bucket list somewhere. But this particular book, how does it happen?
Well, so it was on the list to write a book alongside, work with Turner Classic Movies and be on the red carpet at the Oscars, which are tick, tick. And then so I was actually just chatting with Chris Stuckman, who had a book out, and I just said to him, you know, that's always been one of my dreams. I haven't really told many people, but I'd love to one day write a book.
Right.
And I had been thinking, I've been toying around with some ideas for a book that I was just going to start on my own. You know what it's like. You start and stop.
It's hard, man. Writers need deadlines and people to demand.
Really hard. Things. And, you know, Maud was kind of keeping me a little bit accountable with that. Okay. Maud Garrett. I talked to her about some ideas. And particularly one was about women in Hollywood.
Right.
And so I was talking to Chris Stuckman and I said, oh, how did you go about getting a book? And I just wanted to sort of pick his brain a little bit. But again, I thought, like, not yet. This will happen down the track.
Right.
I thought one day it'll happen, but down the track. When I'm a better writer, when I'm better this, better that, you know what it's like?
Not yet is a dangerous set of words, isn't
it? And so he wrote back to me and said, well, my publishers are often looking for new talent if you want me to put you in touch. So again, one of those moments of like, don't think I'm good enough, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Right.
And I said, okay. So he put me in touch with the publishers. They looked at my stuff and they said, would you be interested in writing a book about women in Hollywood?
Right.
And I said, yes, you know, because I'd been toying with that idea. And actually, in a funny little bit of coincidence, I was just taking one of the many writing courses that I did was about book proposals and how to propose a book. So the idea that I was working on was this as like a book proposal.
Leash, I'm looking through this right now here, and this is a book.
I know. This actually looks like a book.
Not that, I want to make sure I'm clear. I've never doubted that this wouldn't be a book.
It's not a pop-up book.
But this isn't like here's a picture and two paragraphs on you know Rita Hayworth.
It's dense.
This should be studied in film schools.
Wow. It's surreal. When I got that copy, I was like, because it lived as a Word document for so long.
Oh, right, to actually see
that
it's like this.
It's actually a book. But yeah, it is quite in depth. So they said, what would be some of your ideas? And funnily enough, I was staying one class ahead with my book proposal class. Right. So everything they asked for, I was like, oh, we did that last week. I know how to do that. I know how to write a short synopsis and a long synopsis and then how to, write some sample chapters and to pitch this, pitch that. So I put it all together and a couple of ideas, and this was the one that they particularly went for.
Sure.
And then it happened really fast where it was back and forth with the contract, and then it was like, okay, you got a book deal and it's due in 4 months, which ended up pushing to 5 months. And I was like, oh, that's forever. That's long.
I'll start next week.
Really hard. And with my idea, I bit off more than I could chew in terms of wanting to cover everything in the amount of time I had to write and research at the same time.
Well, yeah, just I'm flipping through it here. Again, I didn't doubt this for a second. I want to make that clear. Yeah. But I am looking. This is like this.
It's wall-to-wall text.
It's scaring me. Like the concept of writing a book, like mine would have some pictures and like an arrow pointing to a picture, and then it would say, me like this picture. And I'm telling you, this is. I have my copy on the way.
Yeah.
This needs to be in some kind of school. People need to study this.
Yeah, well, so the idea for this was the fact that I read so many film books when I was young, and I didn't learn that much about the women involved.
Right, right.
It's all about the men involved who did amazing things. D.W. Griffith, Cecil B. DeMille. I mean, amazing stuff. And some of my favorite directors are obviously men, and favorite actors too. But I wanted to learn more myself about these actors and these directors and these people behind the scenes that I'd never heard of. And surprising, given how much I thought I knew about film, when I started to delve into it, I was like, I've never heard of these ladies. And if I've never heard about them, then other people haven't either.
Yeah.
And this is not fully in depth. It's meant to be sort of a guidebook where it gives you the basics about that person, and then hopefully we can go and find out more. But it's just these stories that I thought were so amazing that I wanted to share with everyone. But yes, it was very tough having to research and write at the same time, because usually with a book you have it more figured out before you get the deal.
Right.
Very grateful that I got the deal based on my work previously.
It just kind of happened.
And it just kind of happened. And then I had to lock myself away.
Yes. Yeah, well, you did. I remember we would try to catch up and be like, I can't.
Yeah, no.
At least through March, I have to write. Yes. And writing... Most writers, it's homework for life, as the saying goes. I'm a Douglas Adams fan, and he loved deadlines. The sound of whizzing that they made when they went past his ears, And it's like, so I sympathized, but at the same time was in awe that I'm really in awe of this. But now the title I know comes from the Ann Richards quote, but it's a perfect title for this because again, it's what you're saying. It's not taking anything away from Fred Astaire, but it's highlighting Ginger Rogers.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Tell me about the quote for those who don't know.
I've always loved the quote about Ginger Rogers, which said, she did everything that Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in heels. Mm-hmm. And I always that struck me, that backwards and in heels. Yeah. And I remembered it. And it was actually the first title that I thought of when I started to write the book. Straight away, I was like, backwards and in heels. And then everyone was like, that's so great. I love that title. Yeah. And for me, it is the perfect metaphor for women in film, that they've done amazing things that's alongside the men, but they've just had slightly more obstacles to jump through rather than the guys by their side.
Yeah.
And it also just paints such a great picture.
It does.
And in heels.
It does.
So I started to write it and research, and it was hard because it's like, you can't see the forest for the trees.
Right.
Surrounded by books. I bought so many research books. I was reading, you know, 6 books at a time, trying to keep up. I'd go to the library, wouldn't leave the house for days, that kind of thing, and just really engross myself in it. And I was writing it and the deadlines were happening at the same time. So the deadlines were chronological. It was like, by this stage, you have to deliver the introduction. And then chapter 1 is here, chapter 2 is here, chapter 3 is here. And it was changing as I went in terms of the structure of it. But I got to the end of the first draft before I realized a much better way to write it. So then I rewrote the entire thing in half the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was that? What's the trick?
Well, because
share your magic.
I was writing it, like I said, very chronologically. So it was just going to be from the very start to the very end. Right. And each chapter was going to be on the decade. But as I wrote it, it was so dry. It was like a list of facts.
Right,
it was just like, then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened.
Got to get some narrative there.
Yeah, and it was hard because I didn't, you know, I felt like I was truly just writing it by myself, and I was getting great feedback from the publishers where I was like, oh, I don't know if this is so good. Like, honestly, I think there's a better way to write this. So I actually end up working with my writing teacher from one of my courses who always gave great notes where she, you know, wouldn't tell you exactly what to do, but she would just say, have you thought of this? So I sent her a couple of chapters and I said, what do you think? And she said, you know, the most interesting part of the stories. And I was like, yeah, you're right. That is the most interesting part. And that's what we love. We love stories. We love to hear about stories. So then I picked out where I'd just sort of gone into the stories briefly. I picked it out and then I enlarged it. So then I wrote it and researched more. And yeah.
What are some of your favorite stories in there that you can tell? What were some of the favorite stories that are emerging?
Well, I loved hearing about this woman called Helen Holmes, who was a serial star. And these serials used to play before the feature films, and they were short little movies or episodes before television, and they would always have a cliffhanger and they're always very action based, and this was in the silent era. And she was one of the many heroines of the serial world. And they all have such great titles for their series. Like, hers was called The Hazards of Helen. And her character was Helen, and her name was actually Helen. And then there was, like, The Perils of Pauline. And it was, like, always such great alliteration in the titles. But she did all her stunts herself, or most of them. She wrote all the scenarios as well because she complained that the men wouldn't write dangerous enough stunts because they didn't think she could do it.
Oh, they didn't. Oh, wow.
And at one point she said in a magazine, you know, if a guy can't do it himself, he's not going to write it for me. So I just have to write it myself.
Beautiful.
And she would do these really dangerous stunts like riding on a horse and jumping from a moving horse onto a moving train.
Yeah.
Her character was this railroad was telegram technician who also fought crime on the side, and she would like stop robbers and she'd have all these great adventures and did it all herself and directed alongside her husband. And it was just such a cool thing. And she was really determined to show that women could do it just as well as the guys, if not better at times, in her opinion. This was before women had the right to vote.
Yeah.
So that was fascinating to me. And that statistic that I came across, which is in a couple of film books about how at the silent era there were more women working at the top of Hollywood than there are today. That's what fascinated me and really sent me down this path. And those stories are the most interesting.
Why do we think that? Why?
This is before the money came in, before the Great Depression, and it became like an actual financial business, and they brought in male executives to oversee it. And at that time, of course, women weren't seen as being business-minded or able to handle large amounts of money. The banks had to finance movies once the Great Depression kicked in, and banks didn't want to lend money to female directors. So then slowly it all went out.
Slowly got worked out.
Yeah, but people like Helen Holmes, I love. I also love reading more about women that I already know about, like Marilyn Monroe and Rita Hayworth. And some of their stories are actually quite sad. Dorothy Dandridge, Anna May Wong, who was the first Asian American star. And it's sad, and it's also feels very timely because the same things are happening today.
Right.
Yeah, with stereotypes that they have to fight against based on their race, based on their gender, and lack of opportunity. I mean, Anna May Wong, at that time, their production code was in enforced and that said that there was a ban against interracial relationships on screen. Or if you did have an interracial relationship, then they had to be punished. So usually the woman was punished, you know, on screen by killing off a character.
And what year was that?
This was in the 1920s, okay. 1930s. Yeah, so then...
I mean, not that far.
Not that far.
Not that far, by the way. We're not talking Romans.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. Then you get into the 50s. The 60s and the 70s, and the 70s was when you started to see finally the emergence of female filmmakers.
Right.
When finally they could start to get in there, but it's still a struggle. And then another story I loved was in the 1980s, there were six female directors who decided to take on the Directors Guild of America and the studios directly. Actually, they worked with the Directors Guild. They took on the studios directly to talk about gender discrimination with filmmakers. So they were the first ones to do any kind of research into how many directors women were working in Hollywood. And they discovered that there was gender discrimination. So they took the studios to court and they were very brave. They put their careers on the line to do this. Unfortunately, they lost that case because they were working with the Directors Guild and the studio said, well, the Directors Guild are as much at fault as us. So then the case was thrown out. But they set the precedent for now, the fight that's happening
today. So in other words, they said, yeah, there's a problem, but we're not to blame. Yeah. We're not the only ones to blame. So
exactly.
It's not
so,
a problem. Yeah. And that was the 80s.
Let's look the other way.
That was the 1980s.
Yeah.
Wow. So you put it all in there, you put it all together, and now it is out. It is out, and what is Elish Malone feeling right now? if you're feeling a certain way when you go nail a TED Talk, how are you feeling right now?
Very nervous.
Nervous?
Yes. It is. I mean, you do pour your heart and soul in it.
Yeah.
And even though I approached it with a reporter mind, so I've kept myself largely out of it. I'm just reporting mainly the facts.
It's not Elish Malone story with film.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. But it's still a personal thing, and it's still something that I worked on, you know, intensively. It was engrossing. It was part of my life. And that was a weird thing where you work on something so intensely and then you send it off. And then that's it.
Yeah.
And then that's it. You can't work on it anymore.
The fates are.
Yeah. And I've been rereading it. And, of course, it's like, oh, that chapter's a bit clunky. Done that better. But I am overall, the main feeling, yes, I have a bit of nerves of just having something so personal out there in the world.
Right.
Something that I've done all myself. But the overwhelming feeling is that I'm proud.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that I always wanted to do that I never was sure that I could do. Yeah. And I did it. And that to me is, no matter what happens with this, whether anyone reads it or not, it's successful because of that.
And being accepting of that kind of personal pride, because that word pride can be misconstrued as a bad thing and this thing, and also just for people of our ilk to look back and look in the mirror and go, good job, kid.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
It's hard.
I'm working on it, yeah. I know when I saw this copy and I saw my name, I was like, that's it. That's exactly what you always wish for. And I actually, you know, I've got one of those things at home where you put the letters in. It's like a cinema marquee, like a mini marquee. And so what I wrote to myself last night, and I saw it this morning and giggled, this week it just says, you wrote a book. Just to remind myself.
Yeah.
Write a book.
Damn straight. I mean, it's, again, I'm so proud of you, too. A lot of people are.
Oh, thank
to watch you do this. You know, I met you in the film pundit world, but to watch you get off the train, which is hard, whether or not you like the train or not, I can tell you. Sometimes I love the train and sometimes I hate the train. That's me. Not that you hated things, but to know that, hey, this isn't the train I want to be on anymore.
Yeah.
I might want to come on for a little short ride, but that is hard. And that is so to watch you to do it from afar because you're locked away writing this book. I'm proud of you, but I think it's a big important thing for you to put that on your own little marquee. You wrote a book and to believe it.
I think so.
That's hard. So what's the next book?
Yeah, the next book. I know it's one of those things. I mean, I've never had a child, so I can't exactly equate it to childbirth.
Right.
But from what my friends tell me, who've had that, you know, straight afterwards, they're like, "Oh, never again. That was so hard.
Right.
Like so much pain. Why would you put yourself through that?" And then you start going, "Well, maybe." And then you're like, "Oh, yeah, I'd love to." So at first, I was like, "Oh my gosh, that took everything out of me. I don't know if I could do it again. That's so hard." And then, of course, ideas started creeping in.
Right.
So I don't know what it'll be just yet, but I do want to work on my writing and continue to grow with that and then see what happens afterwards.
A fiction book?
Well,
I could see you writing some classic,
yeah, maybe,
tinged kind of romance, suspense, yeah, thriller, something
exactly
fun like that.
I know. I would love to.
Yeah.
And I also love writing little stories. So I love the personal essay, mm-hmm, thing of the world. I know we both love David Sedaris.
Yeah.
And he's obviously a genius on another level from, yeah, everyone. But I do like little stories from life and maybe little stories from working in this career.
Yeah.
A fiction book about a plucky young Australian who moves to America.
I love it. I love it. On Falls board.
In love with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Well, yeah, that could be the story.
Up, you know?
Have you given Jake a copy of this yet?
I will. You know, yeah, what? I'm going to.
You need to.
I'm going to. Hopefully we'll get to talk to him at the Toronto Film, okay, Festival, which is coming up in September. He'll be there with his movie Stronger.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm just going to do it.
Do it.
I'm not going to like put my number in it.
No, no, no.
I'm just going to write, dear future husband, love your future wife. And then I'm just going to give it to him.
Well,
and
I mean,
like,
look,
hey.
Look, you've hugged him. You've proposed marriage. Giving him a book is
yeah,
far less risky.
I kind of want him to just be like, see, I'm cool, right?
And this,
I'm an author.
I'm telling you, you know, like Ken Burns needs to option this for a documentary series. That's what I think needs to happen.
Yeah, there's so many great stories that would make make a little interesting doco series.
I could see a 10-part series or something like that. I could
for
see that.
Sure.
Alicia Malone, it is great to have you back and emerge from your writing solitude.
Thank you.
With this, I'm so excited. I have my copy is on the way. I actually ordered it live on air on the Schmoes.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
And
I
know a lot of people are in your corner. A lot of people know that this is important stuff close to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to find, as you already have in some pieces, that the world at large, the film world at large, will react to this book in a positive way. And
yeah,
hopefully the not just little 7-year-old girls reading it, but the 7-year-old boys reading it.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone.
Yes,
everyone. And to be clear, everyone should take a gander at this book. And like you said yourself, where we were in 1920 isn't necessarily far off from where we are in 2020 as
exactly
it approaches. And it's going to be an Alicia Malone week here in the Knapsack Files. We're going to do a special episode of the Life Ranked later this week. The book is available on Amazon. Any other spots that we can...
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound,
yeah,
Books a Million.
There's a lot of spots.
Wherever good books are sold.
Wherever good books are sold.
Is that what the phrase is?
That's what it is. Backwards and It Heals by Alicia Malone. Wherever good books are sold. I hope you all out there, I know a lot of you, if you haven't ordered already, I'm sure a lot of Knapsack Files listeners, because you're Schmoes fans, you're Screen Junkies fans, you're AMC fans from back in the day, you're fans of Alicia Malone, support her. Not just so that she can reach spotlight and glory, but that these type of stories can be told and that someone else will get a chance to tell their story, just
yes,
like Alicia got the chance to tell a lot of stories in this book. So I'll say follow you on Twitter, but I know you're not as active on it as you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
We all should back off a little bit.
Yeah,
but,
you know, it's a little bit crazy out there in the world at the moment.
Yeah, we can all get caught up in the whirlwind. Yeah,
about things, and it can be tough. So yes, I'm on there just to post things, but I'm not as active or as involved as I used to be.
Yeah, but you can follow Alicia Malone just like you can follow me at Kat Knapsack. Use the hashtag The Knapsack Files to join this conversation. More with Alicia later this week on The Knapsack Files podcast feed. You can get us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. One of these days I'll get around to Google Play. It takes like extra buttons, and I'm just too lazy. I can't do it. But we are on Patreon. You can support the page on Patreon, and we're going to do some bonus stuff for the Patreon fans who asked you some questions.
Oh,
we're going to
awesome
do that shortly. So for Alicia Malone, for this great book, Backwards and in Heels, I'm Ken Abzug. We'll see you next time.